When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another. As we approach the day where we celebrate the founding of the American nation, it's worthwhile to quickly give a few thoughts to the document that announced our independence, the Declaration of Independence. And with that beginning line, we see two things. We notice a passive tone. It becomes necessary. The colonies have no choice. The course of human events, it's not an occurrence that is happening for the first time. The American situation is being placed by Thomas Jefferson's skillful pen along a timeline of world history with other human events. So we continue. It becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which laws and nature's God entitle them. Wow, the powers of the earth. Jefferson invokes long-held philosophies of the Enlightenment era. Philosophers like John Locke, writers like Tom Paine, who had been writing about things like natural law, and places the American nation on earth as a separate entity, appealing to natural law rather than the king that they feel enshackles them. But, Jefferson says, a decent respect to the opinion of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to make the separation. That is the beginning clause of the Declaration of Independence. And what it makes clear is that the Declaration is very much a propaganda tool. It's an appeal to third parties. It's not a cry for help to the mother country. It's not a just leave us alone type of statement. It's an appeal to third parties. It's an appeal to American countrymen, to farmers and average people to join their cause. It's an appeal to other legislators who might be at the Congress but not yet convinced, or those in the state legislatures. It's an appeal to other nations such as France, Holland, and Spain who might be sympathetic to the American cause. And an appeal to nobles and intellectuals all over the world who might see the American cause as just. This was the beginning of the document that was submitted to the Congress, the United States of America, the so-called Continental Congress, first on the 28th of June. That's when Jefferson dropped off his first copy. We don't celebrate the 28th of June. We celebrate July 4th because there were revisions. In effect, we celebrate the day that the Declaration of Independence was sent to the printer, and that one person, only one person, John Hancock, signed it. The legislative story of American independence, obviously we could get into the case for independence and the grievances that the colonists had over taxation and representation and bad things that British troops were doing to American colonists. The legislative story of American independence actually begins not on July 4th, but on June 7th. And that's when Richard Henry Lee of Virginia made a motion on the floor of Congress for independence. His statement was not as artful as Jefferson's. Resolved, he said, that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. Well, Richard Henry Lee has a way of getting right to the point, but you can see the problem. If you're going to detach from a mother country, it's probably worthwhile to get into a little more detail about why. And in essence, that's what the first paragraph of the Declaration says. So a majority of Congress agreed with Richard Henry Lee's motion, but it was decided that some form of formal Declaration of Independence should be worked on. And the Congress formed a committee consisting of John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Robert R. Livingston of New York, and Roger Sherman of Connecticut, the so-called Committee of Five, to draft a declaration. But anyone who works for a corporation knows, in a committee, there's usually a few people who do most of the work, and in this case, Jefferson got the job, with some help from Franklin. There was a number of reasons for this, but most importantly was that Adams and Franklin, well-known, famous men at this time, and people with the variety of rivalries in the rest of the Congress. If they had written the document, there might be some bias towards it. And Jefferson was from a southern state, and he was also quite a good writer. And so for a good part of the month of June 1776, Jefferson, staying in a house not far from Independence Hall in Philadelphia, worked on various drafts of the Declaration of Independence, borrowing from works of philosophy, from previous documents that had been written in the legislature in Virginia, perhaps a little bit from an English Bill of Rights written in 1689, a little bit from Richard Henry Lee's motion of June 7th, and perhaps even notes that had been run by other patriots such as Sam Adams and other patriots throughout the American country. The preamble of the Declaration of Independence at the time asserted, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and property." But wait, that's not the phrase that you know. The phrase that you know is life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. But originally, Jefferson had written life, liberty, and property. And the pursuit of happiness, that phrase is credited to Ben Franklin, who reviewed Jefferson's draft and made numerous changes, most of which Jefferson accepted. After these preambles that we know of, there was, in a sense, an indictment of King George III and various repeated injuries and usurpations of American rights and liberties that he committed. First off, he has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. This refers to the veto, in effect, that the king had to overrule any laws that the colonies made for themselves. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance. He has dissolved representative houses, houses of Congress repeatedly, the colonial congresses, for opposing with manly firmness of his invasions on the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions from within. He hasn't allowed governments to assemble. They can't run their country. He's endeavored to prevent the population of these states for that purpose, obstructing the laws of naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of land. That's one that's kind of interesting for today's politics because, in a sense, they're complaining about the fact that he would not allow immigration laws. They wanted immigration to increase the population of the colonies, to increase the robustness of the country. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. A lot of what they're complaining about is the king's veto power. This is why later, when the Constitution is debated, the veto becomes such an issue. Should we really give a president the same power that King George had? He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has kept among us, in times of peace, standing armies without the consent of our legislature. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to civil power. And here they attack the Parliament. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should have commit on the inhabitants of these states, by cutting off trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent. And here's the real kicker. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He has excited domestic insurrections among us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. The indictment section is interesting because many think the declaration is simply that, a declaration. It's just a statement. We are independent now. And in a sense it is, but it's also a case to be made. Only a third of the nation, roughly, supported independence. Another third were supporting England, and there was a third in between. So this document was meant to convince people. The rest of the Declaration of Independence talks about how the colonists had not been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. They've made attempts to reach out. Every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. And because of all this comes the conclusion. We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world, that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. That's the conclusion of the Declaration of Independence. Given that conclusion, it makes all the sense in the world that that would be followed by all of the signatures. However, on July 4th, the day we celebrate, this was not so. It was signed by the President of the Congress, John Hancock, and then sent to printers. It was printed and sent all around the country. And by August, there were already copies in England, and it was being satirized in major London newspapers. It was being called hypocritical due to the fact that Americans still had slavery, but yet were calling for liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Other parts of it were pulled apart. On July 9th, Washington had the Declaration of Independence read to the troops at Valley Forge. It was only on July 19th that the Congress decided that each member should, having voted for this, on July 2nd, each member should sign it. And so it was not till August 2nd that most of the delegates, the 56 people, signed the Declaration of Independence. And they were, from New Hampshire, William Whipple, Matthew Thornton, Josiah Bartlett. Those of you that watch the West Wing TV show will know that's where the name for the character Martin Sheen plays comes from. Massachusetts sent, of course, the patriot Samuel Adams, his brother and the future president John Adams, John Hancock, who would become almost become president, had Virginia not joined the Union, Robert Treat Paine, and Elbridge Gerry, the person whose name is attached to the process of gerrymandering, making election districts. Rhode Island sent Stephen Hopkins, William Ellery, and they signed the document. Connecticut sent Roger Sherman, who would later be a big contributor to the Constitution, Samuel Huntington, William Williams, Oliver Wolcott, they all signed. New York, William Floyd, Philip Livingston, Francis Lewis, and Lewis Morris. From New Jersey, John Witherspoon from Princeton College, extremely well-known, a celebrity and a teacher to many of the men who signed the Declaration of Independence. Francis Hopkinson, John Hart, Abraham Clark, and Richard Stockton, who was later imprisoned for having signed the Declaration, was treated very harshly by the British troops, forced to recant the Declaration of Independence, and died in 1781 before the war had officially ended. From Pennsylvania, Robert Morris, who would also play a role in the Constitutional Convention and would have a big role in the new United States Senate. He was also a major financier in early America. Benjamin Rush, the famous doctor from Philadelphia. John Morton, George Clymer, James Smith, George Taylor, James Wilson, who would have a big role at the Constitutional Convention and become a Supreme Court justice in the future, George Ross, and of course, the famous Benjamin Franklin. From Delaware signing was George Reed, Caesar Rodney, and Thomas McKean. That's K-E-A-N. From Maryland, Samuel Chase, William Paca, Thomas Stone, Charles Carroll. From Virginia signing was George Wythe, the aforementioned Richard Henry Lee, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Harrison, a relative to two future presidents, Thomas Nelson Jr., Francis Lightfoot Lee, Carter Braxton. From North Carolina, William Hooper, Joseph Hughes, John Penn. From South Carolina, Edward Rutledge, at 26, the youngest signer, Thomas Hayward, Thomas Lynch, Arthur Middleton. And from Georgia, Button Gwinnett, Lyman Hall, and George Walton. John Adams predicted that July 2nd would be the day that Americans would celebrate. After all, that was officially the day that the Congress committed to independence by voting for it. July 4th, in his view, was just merely the day that the wording was finalized and that the copy of the Declaration was sent to the printer. It didn't turn out that he was right, and we still celebrate July 4th as the founding of the nation. One could also make a case for August 2nd, when most of the members committed at the pain of loss of property and the possibility of death to the independence of the nation. Yet, I suppose, it was always necessary to pick one day, and so July 4th was it. So now, as this document sits in a titanium case filled with argon gas at the National Archives in Washington, D.C., what does it mean to us in our politics today? It might be tempting to say that the Declaration is no more than just what it was, a propaganda statement that fulfilled its role of inspiring a revolution in the country, of providing a foundation for revolution, of winning over large groups of Americans, inspiring people to join Washington's army, inspiring the army that was there, inspiring other countries to help us. But it has had other effects. By basing our founding document on an assurance of life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, it has led to a foundation of aggressive liberty that is enshrined in American government. There is no doubt that the Declaration of Independence is the true father of the Bill of Rights. For people of the founding generation of America, the document that they were passionate about was not the Constitution as much as the Declaration. The Constitution is a founding document. It's a work of law. The Declaration is more of a statement of who Americans are. It was many of the people from the original Congress that passed the Declaration that saw the need for something more than just the Constitution. Many of the things that are in the Bill of Rights about quartering troops, due process, protection of property, were in the indictment section of the Declaration of Independence and still remain law today. We're still, as Americans, very wary of a standing army. We obviously have a very strong United States Army. It took a while to build one. Still to this day, we have rules that govern the use of American forces in our homeland. But if the Declaration does have some moral or rhetorical power, even today, I think it's partially from the fact that we had to write one at all. We could have, as Richard Henry Lee proposed, simply made a resolution to become independent. Why did we need to explain? We could have sent troops and supplies to Washington, beat the British, formed our own country, and that would be that. But in making a document, we made a case. If we get our independence, this is what we'll do with it: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And having made that case, we were bound to it for our nation's history. Throughout modern history, while the country hasn't always followed the Declaration's promise in every way, the Declaration has been used as a tool to shame us at times that when we're ignoring rights. It's something to hold current actions against. And not every country has a document like that. With History Beating Up Politics, I'm Bruce Carlson.